This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Ben E. King sang lead with the Drifters before embarking on a solo career. He died April 30th at age 76. His voice was heard on many classic recordings from the 50s and 60s. His biggest hit was a song he wrote.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see. No, I won't be afraid. Oh, I won't be afraid. Just as long as you stand by me. So darling, darling, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Stand by me. If the sky that we look upon.
Stand By Me made it to number 4 in the charts in 1961. 25 years later, Stand By Me was used as the theme for the film of the same name. The record was re-released and landed back in the top 10. Other Ben E. King solo hits included Spanish Harlem, Don't Play That Song, and I Who Have Nothing. With the Drifters, he recorded There Goes My Baby, This Magic Moment, and I Count the Tears. Terry Gross spoke with Ben E. King in 1988. Before Ben E. King ever sang on stage or in the recording studio, he sang with his friends on the streets of Harlem.
I was born in Henderson, North Carolina, so I wasn't familiar with the street singing thing until I came to New York, which I was about 11 years old when my parents first moved to New York. And I heard about it, and then gradually, by being in the streets of Harlem, I walked around and, surely enough, bumped into different little guys singing and doo-wopping on the stoops and stuff like that. So I was more or less introduced to it when I first got to New York.
Now, you also sang, before you started recording, you sang at Amateur Night at the Apollo Theater in Harlem. Did you all have matching suits in your group?
We had, pink jackets.
Oh, great.
I know, right? That's what I said. Pink jackets and black shirt and black trousers. I mean, it was a sight to behold there. Yeah.
Did you save up for the suits?
Yeah, we did. Well, what happened was that our parents gave us some money for it, because we were all, like, in school, you know, so our parents gave us money to go and buy these little uniform jackets and stuff, and we just found our own black trousers and stuff.
Now, you sang with the Crowns.
Yeah.
The Five Crowns, and you sang bass before you started singing lead. Can your voice still go that low?
I think so. Yeah, Kent, I'm naturally a bass baritone, so I can sing bass still, I think, yeah.
Did it have a certain prestige to be the bass man in a vocal group?
Well, girls always thought so. Girls like the bass singer, I guess, because he had that more mature depth to his voice. And at that time, you have to realize that most of the bass things were done in the doo-wop groups and stuff like that, was the featured thing in the song, you know. So the bass singer was the one that was doing the doo-wop-a-doo-wop-a-doo-wop-a-doo-doo, all that stuff, see, so you couldn't go wrong with that. I had the chance to do all those things, and the girls was just standing around and giggle and stuff. So I think that was, you know, getting me introduced to the females there.
You went from bass singer with the Crowns to lead singer with the Drifters.
Yeah.
And before I ask you to tell us a story about how the Crowns became the new Drifters and how you got to sing lead, I want to play the first song that you recorded singing lead as the lead singer of the Drifters. And
okay.
This is There Goes My Baby.
Oh, oh. There she goes. There she goes.
Benny King singing lead with the Drifters on There Goes My Baby. So tell us how the Crowns, who you sang with, became the Drifters?
Well, that's one of those strange stories, really. I joined the Crowns because the guy that was managing them by the name of Lover Patterson lived across the street from my father's restaurant. So he came in one day and asked me to join the Crowns. He brought them into the store and we rehearsed in the back of my father's restaurant and I became a member. And the Crowns were, I would imagine, a very good, like, vocal-type group, semi-pro. And we opened up at the Apollo with Ray Charles and I think it was Faye Adams on the bill. And, of course, the Drifters were on the bill as well. And we were the opening act. During that week, we were approached by their manager, George Treadwell, and he had mentioned to us that he had been watching us and he thought we were a very good group and would we be interested in becoming a new set of Drifters.
He had just, what, fired Clyde McFadder, who had been the lead singer.
Yeah, well, what had happened in that, I think Clyde really wasn't in the group at that time. Clyde had more or less gone solo, but the other members were in the group. And he had, had problems with the group, or the group had problems with him. And they decided to just split company, and they did so, you know.
Right, so Clyde McFadder had left the group, and then the producer fired the rest of the Drifters. That's the way it worked.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And when the producer decided that your group would be the next Drifters, did they do anything different with you or tell you to do anything different for you to become Drifters?
Not really. I think that was the strange thing about the whole situation is that when we became a new set of Drifters, there weren't any instructions at all given to us. You know, we used to go on the road as the new set of Drifters before the record was released, and we were booed off the stage, and we had bottles thrown at us and chairs and the whole nine yards. So we weren't given any warning to what to do, how to act. We got uniforms, and I think we got a new station wagon or something like that. But that's the only thing that we received as far as become a new set of Drifters, as well as the fact that we had to fulfill the Drifters' recording contracts, and we weren't aware of that. You know, we were just four or five kids coming out of Harlem from a very, very amateurish background. Even during the time with the Five Crowns, we were just more or less, as I said before, semi-pro. So we didn't know about all the particulars that professionals would go through to more or less make a living in the business.
You got booed because the fans were expecting the other Drifters, and
yeah,
here you
exactly.
were with no explanation.
That's right, exactly. Well, it's like going to see the Four Tops, and all of a sudden the curtain opens, and there's four guys about 17 years old. I mean, that's the kind of thing that you would face. Yeah.
Now, when you were telling us about the Crowns, you had sung bass with the Crowns, but you ended up singing lead when the Crowns became the Drifters.
Yeah.
How did you get to sing lead?
I wrote the song There Goes My Baby while we was on the road, and when I got back to New York, I showed it to Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller, who produced the date. And while we were in the studio, I was trying to show the lyrics to Charlie Thomas, who was the lead and did all the tenors to the songs. And for some strange reason, he couldn't get the feel of the song. And Jerry Wexler, who was involved with the date as well, came into the control room and said, look, Charlie's having trouble with this song. You sing it, you know. And I just went to the mic. I had an advantage over him because I had written the song anyway. So I went to the microphone and started singing. And I was stuck with lead since then.
Stuck, huh?
Yeah, stuck, right?
Well, I want to play another song that you recorded with the Drifters. And this is Save the Last Dance for Me. Of course, you're singing lead on it. This is a song that made it to number one both on the R&B charts and on the pop charts, which was a pretty big deal. Really.
Right. No, that was a great deal during that time, because in that time you have to allow for the fact that they weren't actually playing a lot of black records. And not only weren't they playing a lot of them, they weren't even thinking about crossing them over.
Mm-hmm.
You can dance every dance with the guy who gives you the eye to let him hold you tight. You can smile every smile for the man who held your hand neath the pale moonlight. But don't forget who's taking you home and in whose arms you're gonna be. So darling, save the last dance for me. Oh, I know that the music's
yes,
fine, like sparkling
oh,
wine. Go and have your
yes,
fun.
I know.
Laugh and sing.
Yes, I know.
But while we're apart,
oh,
don't give your
yes,
heart to anyone.
Oh,
but
yes,
don't forget who's taking you home and in whose arms you're gonna be. So darling,
say
the last dance for me.
Baby, don't you know I love you so? Can't you feel it when we touch?
Well, that still sounds very terrific.
Thank you.
I never got to see the Drifters perform in the early 60s. And I was wondering, we were talking a little bit earlier about choreography. Did you have a lot of choreography in your act?
Not a lot. We did, there are steps that I call short steps. And short steps are done like by groups like Platters and Drifters. And then the fast, wide steps are done like Gladys Knight and the Pips and Temptations do wide and fast. And there was the Olympics, a group called the Olympics. They do fast movements and fast steps. We do little short, cute things, you know, things that don't require a lot of sweating and falling down. I'd never learned how to do the split and stuff like that. You know, I left all that stuff out. I don't know that. I don't know nothing about doing the split. I could never get into that. Yeah.
You never took off your jacket and threw it into the audience?
I did that.
Did
yeah,
you?
Yeah, I did that. That was those things. It was great. That was easy, you know, and throwing your handkerchief away and stuff. I did those brave things, you know.
I used to love that at the rock and roll shows.
Oh, it was
great.
Yeah,
a
lot of fun, that.
Yeah. You know what I'd like to do? I want to ask you about how you started to perform solo. So why don't I play some of the record that launched your solo career?
Okay.
And this is Spanish Harlem. Benny King, would you explain how you left the Drifters and started singing solo?
Well, once we got involved with all the recordings and we had all the hit records that we had once we started with the Drifters situation, we were on salary as the new set of Drifters, and we were making like maybe $100 a week or somewhere in the neighborhood. And we were all more or less trying to make ends meet, because that $100 would have to keep us alive on the road and, of course, tried to send some money home. So we, in other words, to make a long story short, we had managerial problems. And I along with Charlie Thomas, Doc Green, and Ellsbury Harp, we had discussed trying to go to George Treadwell and ask for a raise. And this is a group with a number one record.
Mm-hmm.
And once we got to the office, we had set up a meeting, we got to the office to discuss this problem that we were having as far as salary. He told me, instead of me standing up to speak for the group, to speak for yourself, and I did so, and he fired me. He was great at firing people. And I walked out of the office, assuming that the other guys would follow, and they didn't. The only guy that followed me was the same one that came across the street to my father's restaurant and convinced me to join the Five Crowns, who was Lover Patterson. And it was his determination and his, feeling that I had something in my voice that he insisted that I stayed in the business, and he was the one still I find very responsible for me still being here now. You know, I hold him very near and dear. He's long passed away for many years now, but to answer your story, he's the reason why I more or less stayed and started a solo career. The record that you just played recently was Spanish Harlem, was originally supposed to have been a Drifter record. And although I was out of the group, Atlantic, which a lot of companies at that time was doing that, they would call the lead singer back in the group and pay him scale just to keep the sound in the group. So they were doing that to me as well. That's why if you look at my recording world, the things that go on with me as far as a recording artist, you'll find that I left the group in 1960. But yet and still, I recorded a record with the group in 1962. And yet and still, I had my own solo career started in 1961. It's very crazy, all that. That's because Atlantic would ask me to come back and to do some Drifter recordings and just pay me scale.
But did you think of Spanish Harlem as a solo record or a Drifter
no,
record?
No, 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 no. Get back to that problem. That what happened that it should have been a Drifter record. Jerry Lieb and Mike Stoller, who at that time we had developed a very strong friendship as writers and producers and friends, and they're the ones that went to Atlantic and spoke to Ahmet Erdogan and asked him would he consider a Spanish Harlem being a Benny King record opposed to a Drifter record, and that's how I started a solo career with that record there, really.
I want to play one of your solo records that I think is one of the most dramatic-sounding pop songs I know, and this is I Who Have Nothing, and this is really high drama. I love this record. As everyone will hear, there are great pauses in this record, and when you come on, there's like timpani behind you.
Mm.
Were the pauses written in? Did you decide how long to pause? Did you know the timpani was going to come in with you?
Some of the things I would rehearse with Jerry Lieb and Mike Stoller, but that was just three guys around a piano. So most of the performing things that was done on the records was just the way I felt at that time. I'm not one of those regimented type recording persons where I know exactly what to do at each particular time in a song. I just close my eyes and go for it. Yeah.
Well, let's hear it. This is Benny King singing I Who Have Nothing.
I who have nothing, I who am no one, adore you and want your soul. I'm just a no one with nothing to give you but all. He buys you diamonds, bright, sparkling diamonds. But believe me, dear, when I say that he can give you the world, but he'll never love you the way I love you.
It breaks me up every time I hear that. Were you as emotionally involved in that recording as you sound?
Yes. I think what happened in that is that my manager and I, to make a long story short, my manager and I, at the time, his name is Al Weil. We were traveling over to Europe to get myself established over in the European market. And we got up one night while we were in Rome, and he had found this songwriter, and we went by this office. And this guy, he was Italian, of course, and he was speaking in Italian. He was playing Italian songs, but he played this one particular song, and my manager and I picked it up right then and there and said, this is a hit record. The guy was singing in Italian, had the same kind of deliverance and the same kind of feeling about the song. I didn't know what the words were saying, but I know the feeling was great. When I got home and we showed it to Jerry Lieb and Mike Stoller, and they wrote the English lyrics to it, we knew that the song was great. I think that during that time when I was singing songs, I got very, very involved with it. The whole feel of the song. It's amazing when you grow older, your attitude changes, and you tend to not be as involved and not as, you don't throw your whole self into songs. I listened to myself when I was singing years ago, and I prefer my performance much more than I do today. And I did that with a feeling. When I was doing I Who Have Nothing, I tried to at that time compliment a song as a songwriter would have meant it to be.
Now, you also recorded Stand By Me as a solo record. Now, you wrote that record.
Yeah.
You wrote, and someone named Elmo Glick gets co-writing credits. Did he co-write it with you, or was that
Elmo
someone who
Glick was a silent partner for years. Elmo Glick is the pen name, I found this out maybe 4 or 5 years ago, of Jerry Lieb and Mike Stoller.
Oh, no.
Those were my ghostwriters, and I didn't know it for many, many years. So just go to show you, right? Yeah. But yeah, as I said earlier, you know, we were just kids out of Harlem with no knowledge at all about legalities and what should happen and what shouldn't happen in this business. And I'm only one out of hundreds and thousands of the artists that got those things happen too, you know. So
well, a lot of artists were deprived altogether of writing credits. So
oh, gotcha.
So I guess in some respects, it was.
I was lucky. I'm one of the lucky ones. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
I'm one of the lucky ones.
Well, I love your singing, and I thank you so very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Benny King speaking to Terry Gross in 1988. The singer and composer died April 30th at age 76.